ComeToCancer.org.
Closing argument. Walter Hudson. Pursuing happiness thoughtfully. 8 to 10 weeknights on Twin Cities News Talk. AM 1130 and 103.5 FM.
So, an open question for you guys tonight. Feel free to call in and participate by giving us an answer, your answer. Should we go to war with Iran? Yes or no? And your reasoning, one way or the other. From the Star Tribune, President Donald Trump declared Thursday that Iran made a very big mistake by shooting down a U.S. surveillance drone over the Strait of Hormuz, but suggested it was a foolish error rather than an intentional escalation of the tensions that have led to rising fears of open military conflict. Asked about a U.S. response, the president said pointedly, "You'll soon find out." So something is apparently in the works. I mean, I imagine that's what he means. It would be something to say that and then have nothing happen. That'd be odd. But I guess we can't put anything past him. Certainly, he's a master of sleight of hand politically. It drives his enemies nuts. But the question I put to you is, should we go to war with Iran? Have they crossed a red line by shooting down one of our drones, by allegedly mining the strait and attacking tankers, none of which I believe actually belonged to the United States or to United States companies. But nevertheless, certainly there are economic interests there. I don't think we can just allow Iran or any other entity to prevent us from engaging in trade, particularly when it comes to oil, which is, like it or not, the lifeblood of our economy. So there is a legitimate economic interest there, and we shouldn't allow ourselves to be pushed around. But what does that mean in terms of what we're willing to do in terms of military action? 651-989-5855 is the number to give us your answer and participate as we dig through other topics here tonight on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app, we are here 8 to 10 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. Breanne taking your calls and producing the show. So I wanted to bring one of our online debates onto the show. I put up a post on the Closing Argument with Walter Hudson Facebook page yesterday, and it was a KSTP post from their television local ABC, I believe it is, affiliate. And we haven't talked about it yet here on the program because there really wasn't a context where it made sense to talk about it. But the sidewalks in Minneapolis have received a fresh coat of paint ahead of the Pride Festival, and they've been made out to look like rainbows. The crosswalks have. And my comment on this was that it's another example of what seems to me to be the mounting evidence that the LGBT community is far from oppressed and marginalized. And I wanted to use this to ask the question, and this is another one you can chime in on, what does it mean to be oppressed and marginalized? Like, what are the boxes you have to check in order to actually be able to have a legitimate claim to being oppressed or being marginalized in a society? And, you know, one of our listeners engaging with me on Facebook cited the fact that Mike Pence is the vice president. And, of course, Mike Pence is one of the favored boogeymen of the LGBT community. And he's always pointed to and cited as this unholy figure of oppression, this Hitler-like figure. We're going to talk about Hitler comparisons here tonight as well as we get later into the program. He's always cited as this big bad amongst the LGBT community. And my question to Catherine, the listener who was engaging with me here on Facebook, was why? What is Mike Pence doing to the LGBT community? You know, his name's tossed around like he's this big boogeyman, but I've yet to hear what he's done that's so egregious. So he's against gay marriage. All right, I'll grant you. in that he holds exactly the same position as both Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton did about 5 minutes ago, right? Like, lest we forget that 10 years ago, we were all against gay marriage, okay? It went from being like a 90-10 issue to flipping 90-10 in the other direction in about 10 years. So this idea that Mike Pence is some sort of weird aberration, he's some sort of bizarre, monstrous, inhuman, because he has refused to renounce his religious convictions and stands by his faith and stands by his belief on what marriage is and sexual orientation and gender identity and all of these issues, these social issues, strikes me as more than a little manufactured, more than a little bit of kabuki theater, clutching at pearls and rending of robes in theatrical fashion to display how offended you are. When the people who you voted for 4 years ago, 6 years ago, 10 years ago, held the exact same position that Mike Pence still does. It strikes me as odd. So what is he doing that is such a threat to the LGBT community? And I ask this in the context where, again, as reported by the local ABC affiliate, we're painting the crosswalks rainbow colors for the Pride Festival. As you scroll through your feeds on social media, every single corporation has changed its logo to the rainbow flag, which, whatever, okay, they're marketing to their consumers, which, can we just pause to acknowledge that the population of LGBT, the percentage of the population that's LGBT, has not increased in the past 10 years. They are marketing to all of us, to the mainstream culture. That's who they're marketing to with this Pride Month accommodation and changing their logos to the rainbow flag, which should tell you that we're not dealing with an oppressed and marginalized community. This is not what oppression and marginalization looks like. You want to know what oppression and marginalization looks like? Go to Egypt. This comes to us from the Daily Wire. Earlier this month, a young Coptic woman from Sosha in the Minya province of Egypt reappeared in her village after a two-month disappearance. But she returned in a different state, married to a Muslim man and pregnant with his child. Muslim celebrations over her newfound conversion, marriage, and pregnancy devolved into riots, house burnings, and attacks on her Christian family and community. This was no accident. The woman and her new husband were brought back during the celebration of Eid, when tensions between Muslims and Coptic Christians are high. In reality, this incident was part of an intentional campaign of persecution against the largest Christian community left in the Middle East. Local reports suggest this young woman's case was yet another example in a horrific trend of forced conversions. Though Copts in Minya and other regions face various threats of violence, Coptic women in particular are vulnerable to abduction and forced marriage to Muslim attackers who subject them to rape, blackmail, and slavery. Such conversions, quote-unquote, create a tragedy for both the victim and the loved ones they are forced to abandon. Families face increased targeting by attackers, and those kidnapped cannot legally convert back to their chosen religion, leaving them isolated from their communities. Think about that. So you're kidnapped, you're forced to marry someone who you don't want to marry, you are raped, you are blackmailed, you are enslaved, and it is against the law for you to leave that abuse. This is what oppression looks like. This is what marginalization looks like, and there is nothing even remotely close to it that is currently happening in the United States to the LGBT community, or that has happened in recent or even modern history. In fact, nothing to this scale, even remotely close, has occurred to the LGBT community. The biggest complaint that the LGBT community has had is police brutality, which I agree. There should be no police brutality. The Stonewall riots were justified. And also physical violence, assaults, murders that have taken place informed by bias, which are against the law and that the mainstream culture does not tolerate. At no point has it been, because in Egypt, what happened to this woman is legal. There are no governmental sanctions against it. In fact, it's illegal for her to act in her own defense and to rectify her situation. It is endorsed by the state, the abuse of Coptic Christians. No such claim can be made from the LGBT community. This is the difference between real and fake oppression, marginalization, and degradation. And I'm a little sick of granting the credibility and the authority, the moral authority that comes along with those terms of being oppressed and being marginalized to individuals and groups of people to whom it does not rightfully apply. Let's talk to Dom from Maple Grove. Welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Walter. Thanks for taking my call. A couple of quick points. You know, the tanker was Japanese, but the drone was definitely United States. But it kind of quickly, your discussion reminded me of a street brawl I witnessed many years ago when I was going to college. One guy was being bullied. The guy being bullied was bigger than the guy that was the bully. He broke his radio, and I was just, he was a friend of mine, and he was watching him and said, you know, why don't you just go punch him out? He said, you know, he almost.
Did we lose you, Dom?
I'm a lot bigger than him. I don't need to take the punch at him for an inanimate object, which is my thinking on this thing. A drone is a $100 million device or whatever it costs. Is still an inanimate object. If I was making that call, wouldn't put American lives at worst risk, because I don't know that they would have a proportionate response. I'm not quite sure what that's going to look like.
Mm-hmm.
But we need saner heads to prevail. I'm talking as an American citizen who is concerned about somebody going out there getting shot because of a stupid piece of metal. I'm not demeaning what they did. I'm not diminishing their thing, but this is my thought process on this. We've been doing this for a long time. And when you say we, people around, you know, globe who want to go to war on a whim, and that, I don't even want to call it a war. I'm just apprehensive about, you know, these politicians. The problem with that is too many of these politicians do not have a stake in this because it's a voluntary army. That's the problem. If you could bring the conscription back, you know, like, you know, everybody used to go to join the army for 2 years, I wouldn't have any problem with that.
Well, but see, when we had that, though, and I got to cut you short, Don, because we're up against a break. I appreciate the call. But when we had the draft, when we had conscription, the people who are in positions of authority and power were able to get out of it anyway. I mean, draft dodging, both the kind of pedestrian, bluntly illegal variety, and also the, oh, you know, I have a lot of money, I'm well connected, I can find a way to exempt my son from having to serve. Both of those types of draft dodging occurred under that system, so I don't think it would have the restraining effect upon military decisions that you think it might have, Don, but I appreciate your comment regardless and the position that you've taken. And the question stands, should we go to war with Iran because they shot down one of our drones and bombed some Japanese oil tankers? 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hodson. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, Twin Cities. We're real big on defining terms here and being accurate in terms of the language that we use. And I'm sick and tired of the overuse and abuse, frankly, of terms like oppression and marginalization and bigotry. These are terms that are thrown around with reckless abandon, and that it ends up diluting the potency of what they actually mean. And it becomes a boy who cried wolf type scenario whereby you end up desensitizing people to the impact that actual manifestations of oppression, marginalization, and bigotry ought to have. And it's particularly hypocritical. You know, I compared and contrast in the last segment the claims of the LGBT community of how oppressed they are in the midst of an entire month you know, listener Pat points out that veterans get one day, right? But we're going to give the LGBT community an entire month to flaunt and celebrate their way of life, but they're oppressed and they're marginalized and something simply must be done. It's a tough pill to swallow, particularly when you compare it to actual indications of oppression or manifestations of oppression and marginalization, like the persecution of Coptic Christians in Egypt, where it is actually legal to kidnap, rape, abuse, enslave people of a minority religion. That's what oppression looks like. And if we're going to use the word, we should be referencing something like that. There is something domestically, because, you know, maybe you don't care what happens to Coptic Christians in Egypt. But we do have a domestic manifestation of oppression and marginalization right here in these here United States that is widely accepted and supported by the government and the culture. And that is the oppression and marginalization of the unborn, who are murdered by the tens of thousands, indeed the millions, with no consequence and actual celebration and applause and enthusiasm. We have women shouting their abortions in the street to let us know how proud they are of the act that they have committed, the act of violence that they've committed against their own children. That is real oppression. That is real marginalization. And it's tough for me to shake that reality in the face of what we're seeing coming out of the left in terms of their kabuki theater regarding the southern border and immigration detention centers that exist in order to process violators of our immigration law while they go through due process to determine their status and whether or not they're going to be deported or granted asylum. Chris Hayes, everyone's favorite commentator over there at MSNBC, put this out on Twitter. He said, children are dying in our care and custody, yet so many of those in high dungeon over the words of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez have shown absolutely zero concern about the deaths of these children. That's from Chris Hayes. And in response to this, I put out on Twitter, I quoted the last part of his little spiel there. Zero concern about the deaths of these children from a pro-abort. Because Chris Hayes is all for abortion. And if he's so concerned about the deaths of children, I'd really like to see it exemplified in his approach to the abortion question. Now, of course, this, you know, prompts all sorts of pulling of hair and gnashing of teeth and rending of robes in terms of frustration and insanity from the left when you point out this comparison. But indeed, how can you expect me to accept you pointing to life as a value, as part of your argument, when you simultaneously support a literal industry of death? And not only do you support it, you demand that I pay for it. You demand that it be sanctioned by and celebrated by the state. Matt Walsh has a piece over here at the Daily Wire that indicates just how absurd this issue has gotten in terms of the fact that there's even a debate as to what it is that we're talking about. He writes that the Cleveland Clinic announced today that it successfully completed its first in utero operation to repair spina bifida in an unborn child. The surgery involves a spectacular combination of advanced technological and surgical skill. During the fetal repair surgery, a cesarean section-like incision is made and the mother's uterus is exposed. An ultrasound is then used to locate the placenta and fetus. The uterus is opened, and the back of the fetus is exposed, showing the spina bifida lesion. The surgeons then carefully suture several individual layers of tissue in order to cover the defect. After the uterus is closed back up, the fetus remains in the womb for the remainder of the pregnancy and is ultimately born by cesarean section. This procedure is not unprecedented. The Children's Hospital of Pittsburgh had its own first ever surgery of this kind several months ago, but it is part of a relatively new and burgeoning branch of medicine. Fetal surgery was first performed in the early 80s, and it has expanded to become more common in recent years as technology has rapidly improved. And then he goes on to list a wide variety of conditions that are operable within the womb and how amazing this is. And he continues, this is all quite awe-inspiring and wonderful unless you are pro-abortion. Then these revolutions in medical technology are rendering the case for abortion more obsolete by the minute. Things have been tracking this way ever since the development of fetal ultrasounds, which gave us a window into the womb and revealed that the little human inside the uterus is indeed a little human. The introduction of fetal surgery yet again affirms this truth. Doctors would not be able to treat spina bifida in a clump of cells. They would not be able to repair birth defects in an inhuman mass of material. They can only conduct these delicate and complicated procedures because the patients are living human beings. The claim that abortion is necessary has also suffered devastating blows. Of course, even without these medical marvels, it could never really be necessary to directly kill an unborn and defenseless human being. That is all the more reason that the case that any number of fetal defects and abnormalities can be treated. The health of the mother justifications are even less relevant. And he goes on to describe why, which is pretty self-evident. And so this is where we find ourselves. You know, this is why I'm committing personally to putting a stop. You know, whenever somebody appeals to oppression or marginalization or being abused in some manner by the system, it's time to put a hard stop in the conversation at that point and ask them, how? What do you mean? Do you mean that you have the legal right to be kidnapped and raped and forced against your will to serve another human being? Do you mean that somebody has the right to kill you without legal consequence? Because those are real forms of oppression, and they exist both internationally with Christians who are persecuted in parts of the world like the Middle East and Egypt, and here at home when we talk about the unborn. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Atson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM.
Walks further down the street with the brim pool way down low. Ain't no sound but the sound of his feet.
I've started talking about the mirror universe, which is a metaphor that I use for the ways in which the left projects the opposite of what they're actually doing and what they actually are pursuing and desire. You know, they call you a bigot, but in doing so and in the conduct surrounding their accusation, they are actually demonstrating that they are bigots and engaging in their own form of bigotry. They claim that they're all for inclusion, but when you dig beneath the surface and uncover what it is that they're actually attempting to do, it's very clearly exclusionary. They want to exclude you, exclude your viewpoint, even exclude your capacity to participate in the debate, in the discourse. And it's very clear once you get past their initial veil of flowery rhetoric what their objective really is. And of course, this is troublesome, you know, when they start to turn to the Hitler comparisons, which, you know, I'm not averse to making Hitler comparisons of my own, but when I do so, it's because they're apt. Like, when I make a Hitler comparison, it's because the object of my comparison is actually doing something that Hitler did or that the Nazis did. Or that they are embracing a principle that was utilized by that vile historical figure. The left, not so much. They go to Hitler in order to conflate and to obfuscate and to confuse and to put up red herrings and smoke screens. And we saw a recent example of that with Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who, of course, is referring to immigration detention centers at the southern border as concentration camps and internment camps. And one expert takes her to task for that. We're going to talk about it here on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Hatson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. You can be part of the program at 651-989-5855. Brianne taking your calls and producing the show. Matthew J. O'Brien did an interview with the Daily Wire. He is the director of research at the Federation for American Immigration Reform, also known as FAIR. And he has over 20 years of experience working in government and non-government positions focused on immigration. And he was quick to dismantle Ocasio-Cortez's attempt to conflate the terms concentration camp and internment camp with the detention facilities on the southern border. Here's what he had to say. He said, I think the point that Representative Ocasio-Cortez is missing is that a concentration camp typically refers to a detention facility where our totalitarian regime's political enemies are kept, and the purpose is to nullify them as political enemies. Internment camp is a general term that in international law is and in typical usage refers to a place where people are held temporarily in a conflict because they are either from an enemy power, from a non-allied power, and there is some sort of national security concern or other internal security concern associated with them. Whereas an immigration detention facility is where people are held pursuant to a democratically passed law because they have no authorization to be in the country, and they are temporarily held there while the government is evaluating their claim to any kind of immigration relief, and those facilities are regulated. The distinction between a concentration camp, which is usually regulated by the totalitarian government security forces, an internment facility, which is usually regulated by the military or by a paramilitary security force, and immigration detention, is that immigration detention is monitored by the courts, and anyone who is in immigration detention has access to the courts to contest any issues they may have with the detention. So to contrast between a totalitarian government using the force of the state to terrorize its political enemies, the temporary internment of people who represent a national security threat, versus a legal process that is designed to protect the safety and security both of the United States and of the people coming into the country, because one of the reasons why we detain people in immigration detention is to figure out who they are so we can vet them, but also that we can determine what their purpose is here. So that, again, is Matthew J. O'Brien in an interview with the Daily Wire taking on in yeoman fashion the absurdity of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's Hitler comparisons and her trying to conflate concentration camps and internment facilities with lawful immigration detention centers. And I really can't add to his analysis other than to note that indeed it is an absurd comparison, which it always is. When the left uses these comparisons, when the left evokes Hitler and the Nazis, they are always categorically and factually wrong. There's nothing even remotely comparable when they utilize those. The only purpose that they have, see, when I use a Hitler comparison, it's to demonstrate something that is demonstrable, that is substantive. When they use a Hitler comparison, it's in order to borrow the connotation, the negative emotional impact of those words, Hitler, Nazi, fascist, in order to weaponize them and use them as bludgeons against their political enemies. Another person who did this was CNN's Don Lemon. Don Lemon, who, in a conversation with his colleague Chris Cuomo, compared Donald Trump to Adolf Hitler. This is what he had to say. He said, I'm going to use an extreme example. Think about Hitler. Think about any of those people. Would you say that that person is allowed? Let's put it this way. If you could look back on history, would you say, well, I'm so glad that that person was allowed a platform so that they could spread their hate and propaganda and lies? Or would you say it probably wasn't the right thing to do to spread that because you knew in the moment that that was a bad person and they are doing bad things? Not only were they hurting people, they were killing people. Now notice at the end there, he tacks on the doing of things and the hurting and the killing, which of course nobody advocates. Like, that's not legal in the United States of America, right? So your comparison falls apart immediately right there. But then right before that, he said the justification for deplatforming somebody, and of course he's talking about, you know, if you could go back in time and deplatform Hitler, wouldn't that be a good thing? The rationalization is when you hear them talk, you know, deep down in your heart, in your gut, that they're a bad person. And so we should deny bad people a platform. You know who else believed this? Here comes a legitimate Hitler comparison. Here comes a legitimate Nazi fascist comparison. You know who else thought that you should deplatform bad people? Adolf Hitler. What do you think book burning was? It was deplatforming. It was the 1938 equivalent of saying, we're not going to allow these people to speak. Who did they target? Yeah, were they burning copies of Mein Kampf? No, they were burning everything else, everything that disagreed with the state line, with the party line. Who's advocating for that today? Oh, Don Lemon. Leftists everywhere. Deplatforming is their go-to solution to the to electoral victory. Ultimately, that's what it's about. They're so upset at what Donald Trump did, which was to circumvent their gatekeeping. In fact, that's the very premise upon which Chris Cuomo and Don Lemon were sitting down to have their conversation here at CNN. They were expressing their frustration with the fact that conservatives and Republicans and Donald Trump are able to circumvent the media gatekeepers through social media. And so their solution is, well, we just need to deplatform them. We need to funnel them back into our pipeline so that we can control the message. It's a very fascistic idea. And it is mainstream on the left. Let's talk quickly to Ted from Minneapolis. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Walter.
Hi.
Yeah, I've noticed lately a lot that you don't agree with the left, the liberals. They coin you as a hater. You're a hater. You're a no good hater. If they want to talk about evil people, let's talk about like three living examples right now. In Syria, Bashar al-Assad using chemical weapons against his own people, women and children, being backed up by Vladimir Putin, Russia, and the genocide that's going on in Venezuela. But then in China, you've got the government yanking organs out of political prisoners while they're still alive without any anesthesia. They're yanking out their organs and transplanting them into people that travel there to get new organs. And then
it's like a horror movie.
It's going on. The Guardian newspaper in Britain just exposed it like 2 days ago. Also, this reparations.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to see a mass wave of new voters that didn't vote last time, all voting for probably more for the reparations part of it.
Oh, I thought you were going to go the other way with that. I thought you were going to say it was going to motivate people to come out and vote for Trump.
A lot of the Democrats, mostly Democrats, they go, oh, yeah, they deserve reparations. And then the Republicans, they're going to vote with it. But the independent.
Yeah, I don't know about that. I mean, I don't deny that it may have. I mean, that's obviously its intention, right, is to try
but
to.
There's going to be a huge amount of fraud because if you're going to give somebody money, that gives them incentive to vote two or three times. And that one polling place in Philadelphia,
sure,
they had 100% Democratic votes at one time, which is impossible.
Yeah, well.
You had massive amounts of fraud, massive amounts of voters that didn't vote last time. And all those ones, the new ones that come in, most of them are going to be voting for that free money. So, I mean, that could tip the tables. And then also, it's going to divide the country even more than it is now, or keep this divided.
Well, and that's the objective. I appreciate the call, Ted. I mean, to go to the theme of what we've talked about so far here tonight on the program. And again, it's the mirror universe, right? Like the left talks about unity and coming together and inclusivity and all. Can't we just be one big happy family that's defined by love? But in point of fact, division is their money maker. What would they do without division? What would a Democratic campaign for literally anything look like if there wasn't some group of people to pit against another group of people? Their entire industry, their entire political industry is rooted in division and group contention and class warfare. That's what they're all about. And so the idea that they would ever seek anything other than that is utterly ridiculous. They'd be shooting themselves in the foot. They would be taking bread out of their own mouths to legitimately and meaningfully seek actual unity, which is possible. We'll talk about it when we come back. 651-989-5855. Closing argument, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM.
And 103.5 FM.
So speaking of being deplatformed, we find ourselves with a proposition from a Republican senator, Josh Hawley. Hawley? Must be Hawley from Missouri. This comes to us from Reason. He's introducing legislation to clamp down on free expression online under the pretense of fighting tech company bias against Republicans. So what's happening here from my read, and you know, to be fair, this is a highly slanted article from Reason. Like, they have a perspective on what Hawley is doing here. But if their interpretation of this bill is correct, which I have no reason to believe it's not, then Hawley is taking advantage of the current sentiment, which we share here on this program. You know, I've talked about it frequently, that something does need to be done about the tendency of big tech companies, Facebook, Twitter, Google, what have you, to unfairly curtail speech that they disagree with and to deplatform conservatives for being conservative, you know, classifying conservative thought as hate speech and bigotry as an excuse to get rid of it. There's this ongoing conversation that we've been having over whether or not something needs to be done to address that from the government. And Howley is responding and taking advantage of that opportunity to introduce a bill that would amend Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which is a measure that prevents individual users of internet platforms and the companies that run them from being treated as legally indistinguishable from one another. So in other words, the current law, this Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, prevents a company like Facebook from being sued because of something that one of its users said or posted on their platform. And without this provision, which is what Howley is attempting to amend, attempting to change, if he were to succeed with this bill, digital companies and the users of their products could be sued in civil court or subject to state criminal prosecution over content and messages created and published by others. State attorneys general have been howling about Section 230 for more than a decade because it means that only the federal government can criminally prosecute internet intermediaries. Thus, state prosecutors don't have the opportunity to seize assets and bring in big financial settlements themselves. As Attorney General in Missouri, Howley, who is, again, the Republican senator in question who's putting forward this bill, joined in the tradition of Democratic Senator Kamala Harris when she was Attorney General of California and the top cops from many other states in begging Congress to amend Section 230. So, in other words, this is a pre-existing political goal, a pre-existing legislative agenda that Howley is taking advantage of the opportunity raised by concern over conservative censorship on big media platforms to try to advance. The first time around, back in 2013, when Howley was pursuing this change, the excuse attorneys generals used was child sex trafficking, falsely insisting that Section 230 stopped knowing perpetrators of this horrific crime from being brought to justice. When that proved a successful ruse, resulting in the 2018 passage of FOSTA, which both amended Section 230 and made facilitating prostitution a federal crime, politicians were emboldened in their power grab for online speech. Now, national and state leaders are insisting that Section 230 must be destroyed in order to fight foreign influence in our elections. The manipulated videos known as deepfakes, fentanyl trafficking, gun violence, and an array of other problems. For some Republican leaders, chief among them Howley, this has led to the truly Orwellian tact of trying to convince conservative internet users that taking away protection for online speech will somehow allow them to speak more freely. That's the nonsensical proposition at the heart of Howley's new legislation, misleadingly called the Ending Support for Internet Censorship Act. And again, yeah, this is obviously a slanted article here at Reason that I'm reading from, but I have no reason to question their analysis, particularly given the supporting evidence of Howley's previous positions on this Section 230 and his previous efforts to get it amended so that states can go after platforms. And, you know, I don't know how that solves the problem. And this is one of the ways that has been suggested to try to combat the censorship online, but it strikes me as very obviously flawed in its approach, because you don't want these companies to operate even more as publishers, which is what the effect would be. Look, if Facebook and Twitter are suddenly vulnerable to being sued for what you post on there, then do you think they're going to make it easier for you to say what you want and speak your mind, or more difficult? The answer is obvious. 651-989-5855. Closing argument, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, closing argument. My name's Walter Hudson. Streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. Thanks for choosing us tonight. You can be part of the program, 651-989-5855. Brianne taking your calls and producing the show. I have another question for you that I invite you to call in and give me some feedback for. In the first hour, I asked whether or not we should go to war with Iran. And we got a couple of responses, both over the phone and also through other messaging, Facebook, Twitter, and the like. And it was universally, everybody said no. So that's, didn't even get the other side represented that we should be going to war with Iran. So I don't know. It's certainly not scientific, but I can't say I'm terribly surprised that that would be the result of our impromptu poll on that particular question. This hour, I'm interested, and this isn't as simple. This isn't a yes or no question. I'm interested in your feedback and your responses to the question of how we ought to think about Islam, and kind of a corollary, how we ought to think about the Somali refugee resettlement program. And this is a topic that we haven't really delved too deeply into here in our 2.5 years here on the program, aside from those occasions where we've come into conflict with certain forces in the conservative movement and the Republican Party that are highly, I'm trying to find a generous way to describe it, highly activated, very deeply concerned about Islam and Somali immigration, and have chosen to utilize sweeping rhetoric in terms of describing the danger that these things pursue. But I will acknowledge this, because I'm looking at a piece here from the Star, that's actually from the New York Times, that talks about St. Cloud, and the headline is "The Backlash Against Somali Refugees in St. Cloud," and they kind of give a profile of a gentleman by the name of John Palmer, who, production note, we should try to get this guy on the program, Brian. He's a former university professor, has always had a cause. For decades, he urged Minnesota officials to face the dangers of drunken driving and embrace seatbelts. Now he has a new goal, which is curbing the resettlement of Somali refugees in St. Cloud after a few thousand moved into this small city where Palmer has lived for decades. And I don't live in, I live about equidistant from this studio in the heart of the Twin Cities and St. Cloud. You know, it's the same driving distance, more or less, either way. And so, you know, having that proximity to St. Cloud, I've been aware of this controversy, and I think all of us, even those who live right here in the core of the cities, are aware of the controversy involving the resettlement of Somalis in St. Cloud. And it's something that I've been interested in learning more about and haven't had the opportunity to delve into too much. But in reading this profile in the New York Times of Mr. Palmer and his cause and his concern regarding the impact, the cultural impact of assimilating or not assimilating, depending on how you perceive it, all of these incoming Somali refugees, it occurs to me that it's a mistake. You know, this is another issue where there's an unfortunate lack of nuance. There has been, like I say, there's been broad sweeping rhetoric that has bordered on, if not crossed the line into, actual bigotry, actual racism, actual Islamophobia, to the extent that that's a thing. And we've spoken out against that here on the program, and I've got no time for it. However, this piece, this profile, and it's by no means the intention of the New York Times to have this effect, but it occurs to me that it demonstrates that there are legitimate underlying concerns that a rational person who is not bigoted, not racist, and does not have some sort of irrational bias against Muslims and the religion of Islam could nonetheless have, and that ought to inform the question of what our policy should look like. And so that's what I'm inviting your commentary on. 651-989-5855. Continuing with this piece here at the New York Times, they write, Every weekday, John Palmer sits in the same spot at Culver's restaurant. And then it's very odd. They have this little blurb where they describe exactly where in the restaurant he sits, which strikes me as an odd security concern. Like, if you want to find him, this is exactly where he's at, right? And begins his daily intake of news from xenophobic and conspiratorial sites such as jihadwatch.org and articles with titles like Lifting the Veil on the Islamophobia Hoax. On Thursdays, Palmer hosts a group called Concerned Community Citizens, or C-Cubed, which he formed to pressure local officials over the Muslim refugees. Palmer said in a recent meeting he viewed them as innately less intelligent than the typical American citizen, as well as a threat. The very word Islamophobia is a false narrative, Palmer said. A phobia is an irrational fear. An irrational fear. There are many reasons we are not being irrational, he said. In this predominantly white region of central Minnesota, the influx of Somalis, most of whom are Muslim, has spurred the sort of demographic and cultural shifts that President Donald Trump and right-wing conservatives have stoked fears about for years. The resettlement has divided many politically active residents of St. Cloud, with some saying they welcome the migrants. But for others, the changes have fueled talk about white replacement, a racist conspiracy theory tied to the declining birth rates of white Americans that has spread in far-right circles and online chat rooms and is now surfacing in some communities. So, you know, you can tell, obviously, the New York Times has their slant, their take on which side of this conversation has merits. Liz Bachlach, a member of C-Cubed, I'm pretty sure I botched the name, who unsuccessfully ran for St. Cloud City Council last year, said, if we start changing our way of life to accommodate where they came from, guess what happens to our country? If our country becomes like Somalia, there is nowhere left for us to go. Minnesota's biggest city, Minneapolis, has long struggled to incorporate a growing immigrant population into the city's fabric, but the recent ascension of some former refugees into political power was taken as signs of progress by many liberals. In central Minnesota, which is more conservative than the state's urban centers, advocates for refugees fear that the resettlements could be met with more resistance. And they go on to describe the situation there in St. Cloud. Now, what caught my attention as I was reading this was the blurb there from Liz Bachlach, the member of C-Cubed, which is the organization that John Palmer is heads up or is part of. She talks about our way of life changing to accommodate where the refugees came from. Now, that type of concern is immediately condemned as racism, bigotry, Islamophobia, you know, fill in the blank in terms of the accusations that are going to be thrown at Liz and anyone else who speaks in that way regarding our way of life and the threat posed by unchecked, unmetered immigration from a place like Somalia. However, this is a legitimate concern, is it not? That clearly, by virtue of the fact that there obviously exists, I think this is what the left has to be forced to acknowledge. There obviously exists cultural differences. If there were no cultural differences, then there would be no conversation. Like there would be no basis for the conflict, right? If there isn't something about the culture being brought to St. Cloud by the refugees who are being resettled there, then it would be uncontroversial to expect them to assimilate. It would be very easy for them to assimilate into the culture of St. Cloud, and it would cause no disruption and no differences, no conflict. By virtue of the fact that the conflict exists, by virtue of the fact that the left takes such offense to the idea that immigrants to this country ought to be expected to assimilate to the American way of life, it demonstrates that there is, in fact, a difference. And if you're going to make the argument from the left, if you're going to make the argument that it's important for immigrants to this country to preserve their culture, then on what basis can you dismiss the concern from people like John Palmer and his C-Cubed organization that we preserve ours? And, you know, indeed, given the fact that it's our country, we live here, it's the United States of America, The primary concern over which culture ought to prevail in the long run doesn't seem particularly odd that you would want to preserve your own as opposed to one that's coming in from the outside. And indeed, the fact that people want to come here seems to stand as evidence that there's something about this culture that is virtuous and desirable and meritorious and worth preserving. So why wouldn't we want to take measures to preserve that? And this is a conversation that it seems to be impossible to have, and I'm daring to have it, which, you know, we'll see how this goes. But it's like, it's impossible to have this conversation because you end up with a lack of nuance on one side or the other. You get one of two perspectives, which is Muslims bad, Somalis bad, they should all leave. That's the one response. And the other is, oh, there's no problem. There's nothing to see here. It's perfectly fine. Bring in 10,000 more, right? Like, there doesn't seem to be a very vigorous, nuanced, sensible, rational view that says, okay, listen, now, just because a person is a Muslim from Somalia doesn't mean that they're a threat to your family. However, there is a real cultural consequence to enveloping and introducing a whole new block of people who come from a very different culture, to drop them in a Midwestern American neighborhood and expect no negative consequences from that to result. Is it even possible to have a nuanced conversation, and what should that conversation look like? I guess that's the question I'm putting forward. Let's start with Anna in West St. Paul. Welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I enjoy your show. I just want to let you know that I listen to it every night. Well, I realized that after we had Keith Ellison and Ilhan Omar, is that how we say her name?
Yeah, that's it.
That's basically, once that happened, I knew, okay, if, you know, bets are off. You know, there's no way that we can stop the influx of the Muslim culture. And at first it was like, okay, I was kind of panicked about it. It was like, okay, I don't know what to do, but I'm panicked about it. But at the same time, especially after coming into the airport last Saturday and just seeing quite a few families coming in from, I guess, Somalia,
mm-hmm.
I realized that I don't really have any power over it. It's like, so as a Christian, pro-life Christian, I say, this is my opportunity for conversion. That's kind of where I've come to the place.
It's a ministry field. That's how you're choosing to look at it.
Yeah, in a way, because everywhere I go now, it's young Muslim women, especially, mm-hmm. not with men, by themselves. And so am I going to look at this, scowl at them just because they're here? And to me, that's not fair. I have a few people that I've met that are lovely people. And so it's like a very, between a rock and a hard place.
Mm. Well, I think that's a healthy way to look at it, that as an opportunity to engage and to minister and to share your faith. And I'm very interested, as you engage in that way, for what the results are. So feel free to give mm-hmm. us a call and let us know what types of interactions you have. Appreciate the call, Anna, and your comment there at the beginning. Appreciate you listening. 651-989-5855. We could chat about this, or we could go into, you know, I have a whole list of campaign-related articles that we can break down. It's up to you. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, Twin Cities. So we got a couple takers on my inquiry. I'm asking for your deep thoughts regarding the status of Somali refugee resettlement here in Minnesota. There's a piece in the New York Times reprinted in the Star Tribune that profiles a Dr. John Palmer, who is the founder of a group out that way that is deeply concerned about the impact that Somali refugee resettlement has had on St. Cloud, and is concerned about the preservation of the American way of life and the American culture. And, you know, my observation is that there seems to be a lack of nuance in this topic. There really seems to be one of two equally outlandish and absurd perspectives. One being that, you know, if you're Muslim or you're Somali, or, you know, you're from a certain background, you're a de facto threat to the United States. And we need to be concerned that you're going to go on a knife rampage at the drop of a hat. Or the opposite perspective is there's nothing to see here. Don't need to worry about it. You're a bigot if you have any concern whatsoever about the impact of tens of thousands of refugees being dropped in the middle of a Midwestern American community. I don't think either of those perspectives is particularly rational. And I'm interested in what the nuanced view may or may not be. And so I throw it to you, 651-989-5855 here on Closing Argument. My name is Walter Utzon. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com. Let's talk to Eric from Uptown. Welcome to the program.
Good evening, Walter.
Evening.
Couple of thoughts on it. The Somalis and the refugees that have come here have shown that they're very, very capable people. They've shown that they can, after a few years, bring out the vote. And I think in 10 or 15 years from now, you'll be looking at a pretty much a majority Somali board here in Minneapolis and in other cities as they go out, because they are very capable.
Mm-hmm.
And they're smart, and they're very well educated, and they have a strong, strong family value. Mm-hmm. And a strong value of God and how they practice their religion. And that is the changing America. That is not a threat to the way of the American lifestyle. That is what America is to become as we become whatever the majority allows us to become. The majority rules and everything changes so quickly, you don't even see it after a while. It just happens. But I do want to bring out another crazy thing, because you mentioned two things that you didn't think were really good. I want to talk about the immigration and the southern borders being open.
Okay.
For a minute.
Sure.
Because this is, in my opinion, the wide open door that we as conservatives are going to leave wide open, because everyone, the majority, let's say 8 out of 10, will vote Christian. Of people that are coming across the southern border. As far as Caucasians, as far as the majority that was once here, it's falling and falling rapidly. As far as brown people, black people, I don't think black people are keeping up on the high numbers either, but brown people are producing a lot more people. And Muslims, who are black, I got to take out the word black here, but people of the Muslim persuasion, no matter what color they are, I don't think color really matters here.
You're starting to lose me, Eric. What's your bottom line?
They're Christians. What I'm saying, Walter, is they're Christian. As long as that southern border voters that are coming across that border are Christian voters, and it is the only, and there's hundreds of thousands coming in, and those are replacing the Caucasian voters and whatnot that have.
So if I'm following you, what I hear you saying is that there is a attrition of Caucasian Christian voters, and that to some extent the influx of immigration from various sources is replacing the Christian perspective because people who are coming in are identified as Christians. Is that correct?
If we want to take in a lot more Christian voters, we have to leave those southern borders wide open. Because the one thing they're going to do is they're going to bring Christians across. And I think as Christians, we know that.
I got to give you the award for the most unique immigration take that I have ever heard articulated on this program or perhaps anywhere. I appreciate the call, Eric. Let's move on to another perspective. Let's talk to Jay from Burnsville. Welcome to the program.
Hey, how are you, Walter?
Good.
So usually I don't call into these things, but this kind of just sparks something with me. And, that was an interesting perspective. But I want to just give a different perspective in general about immigration and this talking about specifically about the Somali influx. And my issue comes not from the fact that they want to come here. That doesn't bother me. The fact that people want to come here from, Guatemala to the southern border, that's fine. It doesn't bother me if they come here legally through the correct channels, which, as far as I understand, a majority of that influx of Somali population is doing so the right way. But what I take issue with is when we have this narrative of they are here and this is their culture and we have to assimilate to what their culture
Correct.
Is, like you mentioned before, what it should be is you can have all the beliefs you want and run your life the way that you want to, as long as you're not infringing on my beliefs mm-hmm. and on my culture, so I can't say Merry Christmas or right. you can't say Happy Hanukkah or whatever because you might offend somebody. And that's part that really, really upsets and bothers me. And right. you can even go down another path of talking about Sharia law and courts and things of that nature. But that's, I guess, the point I wanted to make is that it's not a problem having people want to immigrate to the United States as long as they do it properly. And the allowing them to do so isn't going to infringe on my ability to live my life the way that I grew up in my country.
I appreciate the call, Jay. And Jay articulates what our way of life is. And that, I think that's another question we can ask. And we got the lines lit up. We'll continue with this when we come on the other side of the bottom of the hour break. But, you know, what is the American way of life that we need to preserve? What defines it? And how is it at threat by an influx of immigration, whether it's from the southern border or whether it's from Somali refugee resettlement? And I do think those two things are distinct, by the way, because the resettlement of refugees is something, it's not as though, you know, people are saving up their own money and they're making arrangements to immigrate here from Somalia. They are being aided with intention and often government subsidy and funding to come here from somewhere that's distressed and then being dropped in the community and expected to just get along. And, you know, to what extent is that going to be successful? You're talking, you can't divorce the conversation of the refugee resettlement from what values inform our public policy, because the resettlement is a public policy. Unlike the situation at the southern border, where we're talking about the regulation of autonomous individual behavior, whether or not a person or family decides to cross the border on their own reconnaissance. With the resettlement, you're talking about people taking action under the aid of government, with the aid of government, to facilitate the influx of folks from another culture, another part of the world. It's distinct in those two ways, and I think we need to keep that under consideration as we continue our conversation here on Closing Argument. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.
30 and 103.5 FM.
All right, let's get right back into your calls. I'm asking for perspectives on Somali refugee resettlement. There seems to be a lack of nuance and subtlety on this topic, and I'm seeking it from you. 651-989-5855. Closing argument. My name is Walter Hudson, Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, streaming at TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com and your iHeartRadio app. We are here 8 to 10 weeknights. Appreciate you joining us. Brianne taking your calls and producing the show. Let's take them in the order we got them. Let's start with Joseph in New Brighton. Welcome to the program.
Good day, sir. How are you today?
Good.
Yeah, I like your show, and it really keeps my company going to work and drive, because I drive, so I always listen to you around this time.
I very much appreciate that.
Thank you, and you do a great work also.
Thank you.
Yeah, I came in this country on the also the resettlement program from Liberia.
Okay.
I kind of mix. My father's from Nigeria, and my mom is from Liberia.
Mm-hmm.
So we came because we're refugees in the Ivory Coast, and we got that program because our mother was already here. So she fought for us, and based that she was residing in Minnesota, that was our first state of residence. So we were dropped out here, and we lived here, been here for 20 years now. And I think the difference between our refugees that came on resettlement, the resettlement program from other countries as compared to those that came on from Somalia is the religion. The Somalians are Muslims, so everywhere they go, I think they try to change wherever they go into their, you know, to their religion, and they want to change the situation. They want to change the surrounding. They don't want to blend. They don't want to assimilate. They want to change the place. So they are, that's the difference between those that come from Somalia as on a resettlement program and those that came from other countries. I came from another country. My kids still speak my Liberian language or my Igbo language from Nigeria. And we still do what we do. We bow down to each other. We greet by prostrating. And we, at the end of the day, we still obey the law here. And we don't seem to want to change
right.
This place to where we came from. We assimilate, but Somali won't do it because of the religion. The religion will always want to change where they stay to Sharia law, the teenage marriage and all these things. So that's the difference. And I think if you come to a country, you should be able to assimilate. And I think America is going to be in great danger of change. A lot of change is going to come up because the refugees that are coming, especially that comes from Muslim countries, they don't want to assimilate. They want to change the place into the religion because the religion demand that it change and make those changes instead of assimilating.
I very much appreciate your call, Joseph, and making that distinction between immigration, recent immigration from Somalia through the resettlement program and resettlement of refugees in the past, such as you and your family. Appreciate you calling and giving us that distinction. And I think the point that Joseph makes there is a valid one and completely rational, which is that when you're considering the ability of a population to assimilate into the culture that they are being dropped into, introduced into, religion is a factor, right? Like, religion speaks to your core beliefs, your core values, your traditions, the way that you conduct yourself, the way that you look at the world. And so when we bring in Christian refugees, they're going to be that much more likely to successfully assimilate because there isn't that difference, which is not to say that it's impossible to have an assimilation from a Muslim population, but because it's inherently going to be more difficult, then I think you need to take that into consideration when you're deciding the numbers. I think that's a rational consideration. Let's talk to Rick from Mankato. Welcome to the program, and thanks for holding.
Good evening, Walter. I wanted to thank you for taking my call. I love your show. I may not always agree with you, but at least you stimulate conversation.
That's what I try to do.
The point that I wanted to make tonight is that I think we need to look to Europe and see what's going on in Europe with unregulated immigration and some of the struggles that Europe is having right now. If you listen to the news, there are places where you can't even go. The cops won't even go there in France, things like that. And that concerns me as a guy, as an American.
Well, certainly it's not something we want to see here, no.
Okay, well, that's just the only point I wanted to make. Thank you.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Appreciate you calling the program. Yeah, I mean, the whole no-go zone concept is one that I really need to look into more because I've heard vastly varying descriptions of what that is and how it works. And certainly the most diabolical and dystopian ways in which no-go zones are described is certainly nothing we want to see here in the United States. And so, you know, to the extent that that's actually something that could happen here, it's quite reasonable to oppose that. The question becomes, is it actually something that is happening here or could happen here? And to what degree is it actually happening in Europe? I don't know. It's definitely something I need to look more into. Let's talk to Dan from Minnetonka. Thanks for holding.
Sure, thanks. Let me take you off speaker. Sorry about that.
No problem.
You know, 2 points. Somali population, from what I'm familiar with, are not people of free enterprise. They don't come from a culture of free enterprise and freedom and the Judeo-Christian ideology. They come from a third world ideology. And I see that in interaction with them. I'm certainly there are some, like was mentioned earlier, the Islamic worldview, whether it's subjugation of women, et cetera, is really antithetical to the Judeo-Christian values that our founders had. And you said, what values do we have here? Well, we have liberty, freedom,
right.
You know, rule of law,
right.
And do not favor the poor, and free enterprise capitalism. We're not, you know, it's not a warlord, you know, society. It's not a dictatorship society. It's not a free-for-all society. We have a very complex law and order society based on Judeo-Christian values. And back to the guy that called and said that the Christians are coming over the southern border en masse. They may have some affiliation with the Catholic Church, but I would challenge that idea that they're practicing and devout Christians.
Sure.
And then, but even though they may be Christians, if they don't have the Judeo-Christian founders' view of the world and want to come to America to make it better and to assimilate. I don't think they're coming here for that reason. They're coming only for freedom, safety, and for a lot of public subsidy, of which we will never hear from our media or our government the statistics on Somalian and or Hispanic subsidies and welfare payments and costs, because, and they do vote Democrat. They come over and they vote Democrat. They're largely ignorant of politics, except when it comes to sanctuary cities, which they're all in favor of. You know what I'm saying? My European forefathers came because of starvation. They wanted freedom. They wanted to contribute. They love being American. They're willing to even forgo their language largely.
Right. Yeah, no, this is a point. I appreciate the call, Dan. Appreciate you holding to make it. And that's a distinction that I've made before when discussing immigration, is that, you often hear the talking point along the lines of, well, we're a nation of immigrants, which of course is true. However, there is a vast difference in the quality of immigrant that has come to this country as defined by their motives for doing so in different contexts. Historically, originally, like you go back to the very beginning, truthfully, the people who truly blazed the trails, the people who landed on Plymouth Rock, the original immigrants to what would become the United States of America, were guaranteed precisely nothing. Nothing at all. They sought only escape from the oppression that they were fleeing and the opportunity to establish a new liberty and secure the safeguards for that liberty in a new world. And, that's the type of person who's willing to do that, to leave everything they know with a guarantee of precisely nothing in order to pursue a dream of liberty. That's the type of immigrant that I want. I will take an unlimited number of that type of immigrant. I really, truly would. I would never complain about the immigration of that type of person, that type of character. The problem is, to the caller's point, that's not the circumstance that we find ourselves in. Liberty Hour on Twitter, a frequent Twitter commentator here at hashtag TCNT, pointed out that when you ignore the religious and cultural differences, the refugee situation with Somalis is an industry that would never happen at such volumes without government money. Catholic Charities and Lutheran Social Services get $1,000 per head to quote-unquote sponsor each of the refugees for a few months and then point them to the welfare office at the end of that sponsorship. So there you go. When you have a financial incentive, not just for the refugees themselves to come here, because obviously there are all sorts of reasons why they would want to live in the United States of America, but on top of that, there's a financial incentive for the public-private partnerships, the charities that are involved in bringing them here, well, then you've created an incentive that is a distortion of the market. It's not the same type of pilgrim type immigration that our founders and our forebears engaged in, where they were putting everything on the line. You're getting paid to do this. You're getting assurances, and you're being subsidized, and that's going to foster a different quality of immigrant. 651-989-5855. We'll continue to take your calls in our final segment tonight. Didn't know if we would. I should have known this was going to get us through the whole hour. I mean, I did bring up Somali refugee resettlement, so. Twin Cities do. Twin Cities News Talk, AM 1130, 103.5 FM, 651-989-5855. Got a couple on the line here. Let's go to Steve in Faribault. Thanks for holding.
Hi, yes, I'm just talking. You're talking about the Somali populations. I live in Faribault, and there's a big population of Somalians in Faribault because we have the turkey plant there, and we have the candy factory. And I bet you there's probably 5, 10, I don't know the number. There's 5 to 10,000 probably, but it's a big number. And our downtown's completely changed because people don't want to be downtown anymore, I don't think, because they loiter around a lot down there, and it's changed the face of my hometown. It's kind of sad in a way, but a lot of those jobs that they've taken are jobs that Americans have done in the, you know, before they arrived and stuff. And my mom was one of the people that worked in one of those places, and it wasn't a very glamorous job, but just like it's cheap labor for them, for one thing. So the Republicans like that, and the Democrats like the immigration, like you're saying. That's always the argument. The Democrats want the votes, and the Republicans want the cheap labor. So that's just my view of it, you know. And I work at the University of Minnesota, and I see the same thing there with the custodians. You know, it's just going to be sad. It's going to be sad, I think, is all.
Appreciate the commentary, Steve. We're, of course, talking about the Somali refugee resettlement and looking for your takes. We've been taking them throughout the hour here tonight. Appreciate your guys' generosity and sharing your thoughts. Let's go to Sam in Plymouth. Welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks for having me on, Walter. This is a very interesting discussion. I am an American Muslim.
Mm-hmm.
I grew up in small town, well, not small town, veteran community, America. And what a lot of what I'm hearing is people maybe not necessarily knowing a lot about Muslims and a lot about what assimilation means. I don't think we really define that in the popular culture.
Well, you know how much I like definitions, so have at it.
Well, I mean, that's what I'm thinking, is because people are talking about seeing Muslims and not liking it. To me, that strikes me as some sort of SJW-like snowflakeism. I read that same article. That last paragraph in the article talks about this person was just like, oh, they're just walking around. Well, yeah, because people may be different than you, and they're walking around is not somehow a violation of your rights.
Sure, right. Yeah, so, no, listen, there's definitely a nosy grandpa with his fingers poking between his blinds, staring at the kids playing on the corner type mentality that informs some of this. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. And I think a lot of it, too, is probably ignorance. And I'm not saying that to, like, be maligning people, but I'm thinking they just don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Like, recently there was a Somali immigrant who got to meet Vice President Mike Pence.
Right.
And he's a local entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm.
And that was retweeted by the vice president.
Mm-hmm.
Is that assimilation? I think so.
Yeah, absolutely.
I go to the masjid with doctors and lawyers and members of the local community who make a lot of contributions. That's assimilation.
Yeah.
And I'll say something controversial. Ilhan Omar and Keith Ellison are also assimilation. They're assimilation to the wrong side of the culture war. They turned into progressives, which is a Native American movement. We have them here, right? They didn't come from somewhere else.
Right.
And that means that, you know, they assimilated to the wrong side of the culture war, which I think probably will happen when people say the Islamic world is this, the Islamic world is that.
Sure.
Muslims make up a third of humanity, and there is no one Islamic culture. My wife is Indonesian. I'm American. I know people from Pakistan and Bangladesh. We do not share the same language.
Right.
We share some religious rituals.
Right.
Sorry for talking so fast.
No. I appreciate you doing so because we're short on time and I do have to let you go. And I very much appreciate you coming in to give your perspective on this important topic, Sam, and appreciate you listening as always. And, you know, Sam speaks to the question that I intermixed in this consideration this hour, which is what do we mean by assimilation? And more specifically, what is it that we're talking about assimilating to? What is the American way of life? And my answer to that question, which I've held off giving until right now, is the American way of life, and our callers alluded to it, is life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness, those individual rights, and genuine tolerance, which, again, in order to tolerate something, disagreement and difference have to exist in the first place in order for the concept of tolerance to mean anything whatsoever. And so when we talk about assimilating, what we mean, at least what I mean, is that you come into this country recognizing that we have those values that we pursue in terms of a truly tolerant society where you have the right to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And if you're not on board with that, you shouldn't be here. And the nice part is that anybody from any background can choose to be on board with those ideas. TwinCitiesNewsTalk.com.